Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things we can do for people and the planet. My name's Kevin Folta, and I'm a professor at the University of Florida. And today we have a really special podcast because we're able to speak with Professor Jennifer Thompson. And Dr. Thompson is an emeritus professor in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology in the University of Cape Town, but also served as president of the Organization for Women in Science for the Developing World, and has been an outstanding proponent and leader in the area of technology and advocacy and enabling, especially programs for women throughout the developing world. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Fine. It's good to be here, Kevin.
It's been wonderful to have this opportunity. We've had opportunity to speak together at different conferences here and there, and I've always wanted to have you on the podcast, so this is great. If we could start out by talking about Africa. Now, you're from the African continent. What is the current state of genetic engineering in Africa in terms of the countries that have adopted the technologies and which technologies they've adopted?
It was in the 1990s, and South Africa grows almost, I'd say, between 80 and 90% of its maize is GM, and many of the Africans in South Africa and elsewhere on the continent eat maize three times a day, maize being corn in Europe, in USA lingo. And we also have insect-resistant cotton and soybeans and herbicide-tolerant soybeans. The only country in Africa, apart from South Africa, that is currently commercializing GM crops are Sudan. And those are mainly in the cotton area and not on for edible plants. And this is largely because the well-fed developed countries have told, in many cases, straight out lies about the effects of GM crops. And as a result, the decision makers are very wary of moving into this field. And it's particularly Europe and the Scandinavian countries, because these are the countries that African leaders look to. First of all, most of their aid comes from these countries. A lot of them send their kids to higher education there, and certainly the exports from Africa go there. So with the incredibly negative stance in Europe, that has a major impact on decision makers in Africa.
Now, some people will say, well, it's because there is export issues, that if you use GE crops in Africa, that you'll lose the opportunity to sell crops to, say, the EU or maybe other countries that or regions which don't accept those technologies. So is that really an issue, or is it really more about the fear-based messaging that comes from those places?
Certainly, it's the fear-based messaging, because, for instance, South Africa can export wherever it likes of its GM crops. And in the early days, when Namibia, which is a big beef-producing country, was told by certain people or groups in the EU that they wouldn't be able to sell their beef in the EU if it was fed South African GM maize. And that has certainly not proven to be the case. So it's definitely the personal fear base. I was recently in Tasmania, Australia, talking to them about they have a moratorium, and it's now coming up for review, moratorium on all GMOs. And I was telling them the problems we have in Africa, and I happened to have dinner with two PhD students, one from Zimbabwe and one from Kenya, and I gave them a copy of my last book on GM crops, and they looked at me in horror and said, but GM crops give you cancer. Now, that is absolutely untrue. And yet this is a very deeply felt issue in many African countries. Worse still, I don't know if it's worse still, but Greenpeace, and I've got a slide that shows this, Greenpeace has been showing pictures of banners in which they say that if you eat GM crops, you will become sterile. Now, to say that to an African man is anathema. So influences like this are very hard to gainsay. It's all very well to say, oh, we can tell you the truth, but that message will linger on in the minds of African men.
Is it really just Greenpeace, or are there other organizations that are also propagating the same kinds of messaging?
Oh, no, there are many different ones. I don't have a list at the moment, but there's BioWatch in South Africa and many others. It's certainly not just Greenpeace.
And so what are some of the major problems that exist right now? And I know there's many different layers, and to categorize Africa as a common monolith is a total mistake. But if you were to look across the continent, are there specific problems where a GM crop remedy exists that cannot be adopted?
Absolutely. Cowpea is a very big crop, a major protein crop in West Africa. The technology for insect resistance, because it's decimated by a Moruca beetle that kills it. It's a Moruca insect. And we've had it available for at least 6 years. Some of them will allow limited field trials, but you take one step forward. I mean, Nigeria said at one stage that they were going to allow commercialization. They've backtracked. It's the anti-GMO lobby gets to them as soon as it looks as if they're coming close. I'll give you an example in Kenya, too, of Western influence. There was a study that was done by a French group, they showed potential. They said they had shown that GM crops, maize in particular, corn, gave rats tumors. And subsequently, that paper was withdrawn because it was so badly done. For instance, they didn't have the correct controls, and the strain was one that got cancer in tumors within 2 years. And so all the safety tests are done on them for 90 days, which all the toxicologists say gives you the right results if the substance is going to cause cancer. So this group in France decided, 90 days wasn't good enough, we'll do it for 2 years. Well, of course, they're bred to have tumors in 2 years. And if you don't have the correct controls, you can come to the wrong conclusions, as was shown when the journal withdrew the paper. But do you think that will be erased from people's minds? Absolutely not.
Yes, I remember that was the famous Seralini paper back in 2012. Yeah, and recently in our episode number 182, we did a podcast. We spoke with Francis Onyekachi about the Moruca situation and the resistant cowpea. And I was actually very fortunate to be able to travel to Uganda and be able to go up to the research park and see the wilt-resistant bananas and the vitamin A bananas or the beta-carotene bananas. And we were there at a historic moment when the science and technology minister got Parliament to be able to begin the process to deregulate them. And I was so happy. And the president vetoed it.
Problem, you see. Yes. Even with the GMO bill in Uganda, the whole of Parliament passed it, but the president refused to sign it.
That's it. So it was. So you have one person who stops the progress.
Precisely. And the same was true at the Seralini case in Kenya, because the Minister of Health was a cancer survivor, and she went to the president and said, we must stop all GMO imports and work. And he did that single-handedly without even referring to the biosafety regulatory group in Kenya, and it's still not been rescinded.
It still hasn't been. Wow, that's amazing. So that paper with those rats without the appropriate controls still has impacts in a place like Kenya that would have tremendous benefit from, well, let's ask you that question. what would be the major technologies that would be able to help Kenyans?
Oh, it would be in maize. The Ugandans are slightly different because their staple food is plantains or bananas, but Kenya's is maize.
Yeah, and they have, what are some of the problems they have there in maize?
Well, it's the same as the problems right here in South Africa. It's insects damaging, and it's also lost to weeds. Now, I was talking to a farmer recently, happens to be in South Africa, saying that they've turned to GM maize 5 years ago. Then their yields was 8 tons per hectare. It is now 18 tons per hectare. But she says it's not just the increase in yield, but it's the decrease in the use of spraying that was just toxic to everything.
How bad is the problem of fall armyworm?
Oh, that's huge. That's huge. And some of the BTs can counteract that. But, of course, it's not being used. So Kenya and the whole of East Africa, Zimbabwe, all of them, they could use that.
Yeah, I heard that there was some use of BT crops in South Africa that do have some effect on fall armyworm, but the whole thing needs to be revised because it isn't the right BT or the correct BT for fall armyworm. And has there been additional research that's happening there on the continent in fall armyworm mitigation?
The trouble is, why spend the expense, try to take the expense of doing the research when you can't commercialize it?
I guess that's the big question, is that people hear the word commercialization and they think, well, it's all big companies that are exploiting the African continent. And
no, not at all. Not at all, because in Africa, we have an organization called the African Agricultural Technology Foundation. And they are there to transfer intellectual property from multinationals to African farmers and seed companies royalty free. So we can get it free. But what is the incentive to do that if you can't commercialize it, sell it as at the normal price? It's just, you know, and sell it, buy it from Kenya seed companies, Ugandan seed companies, who would be the who would receive it from the multinationals and sell it on royalty free. But there is no incentive because they can't sell them.
It's something that really has bothered me, because so much of the good research is actually being done there on the continent as well. Especially, you know, but you look at the work by folks like Lena Tripathi and excellent work in Nigeria. And the hands are tied because of a regulatory problem that's been imposed by Western interests.
As simple as that. Let me give you a different example of where the opposite is happening in South Africa. Because we can commercialize crops, GM crops in South Africa, my lab has been working for many years on the development of potentially drought-tolerant maize. And we have a grant from government to take that to glasshouse trials, and if it's successful, to field trials, with the ultimate aim of commercializing it. Now, that's being done through the government. So the seed company who will have, South African seed company, who will have first option on commercialization, will not have to charge the same amounts as excess. They can, because they haven't had to do the research themselves. We've done it at the university. So it's a public enterprise process, and no multinationals are involved at all. But that's simply because the South African government allows the commercialization. So the seed company will be able to sell it for the same price as any other improved seed that they sell that is high yielding or whatever the trait may be.
It seems like there was some traction for the drought-resistant maize that was starting to happen in certain regions, but is that all just being done by traditional breeding, or are there some GE solutions that could work as well?
There are both. It's called the WEMA project, the Water Efficient Maize for Africa, And that has been spearheaded by the same African agricultural technology. They are being tested in many parts. They are being tested in some of the countries that will allow it. So in Uganda and South Africa, obviously, Madagascar now, Kenya, to some extent, they're still a little bit wary of even field trials. But there are a number of countries that are doing it.
That seems like another technology that would be welcome. And when you look at the traditional breeding side, and I was able to see some of this stuff there last year, and it looked really impressive, and it really was seeming to make an impact. And if the traditional breeding side is going okay, then why do we need genetic engineering?
Because different things work in different places, and we must actually have every available technology we can have, because we've got, for instance, insect resistant lines that are bred for insect resistance, and they've been developed in a certain area of the continent. If you move them to a low line or a drier area, they might not work. So because traditional breeding, conventional breeding is very area specific. Whereas if you put the gene, you could put it into varieties that are specific for highlands, for lowlands, for wetlands, for drylands, because you could just transfer the gene more readily. So it might have looked, the conventional drought-resistant maize might have looked good in that area, but if you transfer it to another place, it might not look as good.
I see. And I guess the other big question when we talk about places like Africa in the West, and we talk about technology for Africa, one of the other frequent comebacks we get is, well, we have enough food. Problem is, you just have a problem with distribution. And how much is that is true, and how much of it is really just kind of a Western hubris that feels they should be imposing their food desires on other people?
It's a huge problem of transport. Certainly, there might be enough food produced in certain countries, but those Western countries that those people are talking about have got trains and roads and everything. Whereas in Africa, the roads, sometimes the potholes are big enough to drown a camel. And, there's a very minimal train system in many of these countries. So we simply do not have the infrastructure to transfer food around. The food has to be made where the people, has to be grown and produced where the people are.
And is that really the best solution, rather than trying to come up with more logistical types of solutions? It seems like it would be.
Yeah, that's why I say GM is not a magic bullet. It should be together with improving the infrastructure and the transport and everything. It should also be done with educating mothers, because women who are educated generally have fewer children and they are able to feed their children better. So there's no magic bullet in this game. It's a multifaceted approach we must take. And a lot of it can be women are critical in this whole process. And by helping women to understand and to use these technologies is going to be of huge benefit in Africa.
Well, that's a really good point to take a brief break. We'll be back in just a moment with Professor Jennifer Thompson. She's an emeritus professor in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biology at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll be back in just a moment.
If you've been reading on the internet lately, you know that the question has been raised about how the Talking Biotech Podcast is funded. I can see why. I mean, this would come up again and again. So high-quality, professionally produced podcast like this must depend on deep pockets from some major agricultural concern.
I'm not sure they're getting your sarcasm on that.
I certainly can vouch for the fact that this is a volunteer effort. As the booth announcer for the Talking Biotech Podcast, I get a lousy cup of coffee and my pick of the donuts from the box that Kevin doesn't want. That's it. But that's okay. This enterprise is not about making a buck. It's about sharing science. The podcast is 100% funded by Fulda personally, and no outside funding is considered. Go ahead, try us. Send us a check for $1 million and see if you don't get it right back. The real payment for the effort is the flood of kind words, the growing numbers of downloads, and the great questions that we get from listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and now back to the podcast.
And now we're back on the Talking Biotech podcast. We're speaking with Professor Jennifer Thompson. She's an emeritus professor in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And we left on the other side talking about the roles of women and how the technology can particularly benefit women on the continent. And are there any particular cases where you can point out where the lack of reliable food sources have really strong impacts on women in particular?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example that points out the problem of not always having water on tap. Because in the before GM crops, if you had to spray with herbicide or insecticide, you had to mix them. So first of all, very often the farmers would mix these in with water in a Coke bottle or something that was readily available. And at the end of the process, they would often just throw the Coke bottle away. And then what happens to Coke bottles lying around? Kids get hold of them and fill them with water to drink. And there's insecticide or herbicide in it, which can be harmful. Not so much the herbicides, but the pesticides. And then you have to mix it with water, and water doesn't always come out of a tap in Africa. So who fetches the water? It's the women and the girls. So the women have to spend their time going to water holes and collecting water, which prevents them from getting on with other household chores, planting vegetables, and the girls have to stay out of school. So there's a knock-on effect in Africa of having to deal with pests. And the other thing in Africa is that there are things called men's crops and women's crops. Now, men's crops make money and women's crops feed people. And early on in the life of the African Agricultural Technology Foundation, we were supporting the improvement of the yield of bananas in Uganda using just tissue culture. That was not a GM issue, but the net result was very fascinating, because as soon as the hands, clumps of bananas, as soon as they increased in size from being sort of a half a meter or a quarter of a meter to a meter and more, they changed from being women's crops to men's crops. And the women farmers were quite angry with us because we had messed up their whole system of farming. So we've learned our lesson from that. And we always now take the women into account before we do any investigation of improved crops. And I'll give you another example. We're in a farmer, a black subsistence farmer. Well, she wasn't a subsistence farmer. She was a small-scale farmer. There is a difference. Small-scale farmers can apply to the small farmers in Europe, where their plots are small, but they are heavily treated with fertilizers and all sorts of things that South Africans cannot afford. So a smallholder farmer and a subsistence farmer can be two very different things. So she is a smallholder farmer. She's not a subsistence farmer. But when she started growing GM maize, she got the same yield from half her fields. And so instead of planting the whole field, some of them she left to biodiversity, to the natural field, and some of them she lent out to neighbors so that they could use the soil that she didn't need, because her yield had doubled. So women's attitudes to farming are often quite different from men's attitudes, and this is not always the case in the developed world.
That's true, because it seems like here, at least in the industrialized world, most of the farmers are males, increasingly female. But in Africa, are most of the farmers women, or are there still kind of a mixture?
There's a mixture, but it's becoming more and more the women, because the men are finding more exciting jobs in the cities.
So what is the current state of what's happening with adoption of GE crops in these countries?
Well, I had an interesting time in Tasmania recently, and it was a good example of how facts can be twisted. So, for instance, I spoke at this particular forum, public forum, I gave those two examples of the women's yields being increased in using GM crops, that they, in the one case, had gone from 8 to 18, and the other, it had doubled. And then one of the anti-GMO speakers came after me, and she said, it's a known fact that GM crops can't increase yield. It's only the hybrids that increase it. So, I mean, that would confuse the audience terribly unless they knew that she was talking absolute nonsense, because the genes are put into hybrids because hybrids are tough and high yielding. But without the added gene, you wouldn't have the increase in yield over and above what the hybrid got. So, you know, the audience was nodding sagely as she said this, and I felt like saying, but that's a lie. But I didn't.
but that's the hazard of having somebody go after you in a talk or in in an interview, because it happens to me all the time that I'll say, you know, these are one strategy that can help us increase food security. And then someone will come on next and say, well, you can't believe anything he says. He's a liar who works for Monsanto. Game over.
Right. Game over. Yes. I had a slightly different experience in the, about 20 years ago now, I was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, and I was asked to be on television with Vandana Shiva, who is a well-known anti-GMO activist. And I can't remember exactly what it was she said, but I turned to the interviewer and I said, but that's a lie. And he took absolutely no notice and went back on to asking her further questions. So, it's very difficult.
She's a notorious one for that, too. I know that people have been to her talks, and at the end, if she takes questions, they'll ask, is there any technology or any application of biotechnology that you would agree with? And she'll completely deflect and talk about something completely completely different.
Really?
Yeah, and she actually spoke here in the state of Florida, where we have problems with citrus greening. And, you know, literally 10 miles from where she was speaking, farmers are closing their farms, and family farms are suffering statewide. And she's telling this group of students that this is poison and that these new crops are dangerous. I mean, it is such a misinformation source that's influencing younger generations that then are carrying that message forward. And it has particular impacts, you know, even here in the industrialized world, but that really resonates all the way into the developing world.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, well, I gave you the example of the two PhD students I had dinner with, both of whom said, oh, but GM crops give you cancer.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty egregious. So tell me more about your next book that's coming up.
Ah, this is called GM Crops, the West versus the Rest, in which I'm trying to point out how just insidious some of these rumors and lies can be. But I'm also going to talk about where the developments are happening in the developing world and where things are hopeful. And so I'm also tracing the history of the development of GM crops, and also the whole question of right in the beginning when it was just GM bacteria. And so that's going to be quite an undertaking. I'm getting a lot of information from, there's a marvelous organization based at Cornell called the Alliance for Science. And it teaches, it's a Bill and Melinda Gates funded project where every year they bring for 3 months to the campus groups of journalists from different countries in the developing world, and teach them about the science and how to market and how to run campaigns and all of that. And these people are a great source of information. They are sending me documented evidence of where they are being, GM crops are being undermined by Western propaganda in many cases.
I love the fellows at the Alliance for Science, the people they bring in from around the world. And I've taken part in that, and it's been a eye-opening experience. And actually, one of the students is now here at the University of Florida pursuing a degree, one of the fellows.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's the fellows who are giving me all the information. Yeah.
Yeah, she actually is from Nigeria, and I saw her last year in Uganda, or in 2017 in Uganda, and we had a great conversation, and she said, you know, I'd love to go back to school, and we made it happen. She's actually funded in part through the Center for African Studies, and we have this joint opportunity to have to train somebody who really has a passion in getting a higher degree and then taking back to her original country that technology. So it makes she's one of those folks who just appreciates everything, and she makes me so happy just to talk to her. So,
by the way, one of my chapters is very largely based on your info that you gave at Saskatoon. It's called The Importance of Communication, and it's all to do with trust and understanding the other person's point of view.
Oh, that's really great. Yeah, that's turned into really my centerpiece of the discussion now in all these different issues across science, whether we're talking about vaccines or climate, vaccines especially a problem here in the States.
Yes, indeed.
You know, we've got these measles outbreaks that are now happening across the country, and it all was because of an erosion in trust that started in the beginning. And you see that's what's happening in Africa. You're able to see the undermining of trust by these organizations that come off as benevolent organizations who are here to help you. And they take away the trust that the science-minded, either whether it's scientists or whether it's politicians who are working there, that's the basis of this. And how much of that trust is really due to that lapse of trust is due to maybe kind of colonialism or any kind of maybe older issues that still are around there on the continent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the book you're working on now is really just the fourth of the series. Could you tell me a little bit about the other ones?
The first one was called Genes for Africa. It was published way back in 2002. And it was just talking about how genetic engineering can happen. It was sort of like GMO 101, but it also had a very strong concentration on Africa and other developing countries. The second one, this one was quite amusing the way it started, because the president of the Rockefeller Foundation at the time was Gordon Conway. And he wrote a book review for Nature on it. And he started out by saying, this is a gem of a book. But he ended by saying, not enough on the environment. And he's an ecologist. So I then went on to write Seeds for the Future, which is about specifically genetically modified crops and the impact on the environment. And that was out in... that came out in 2006. And then in 2013, my latest book was Food for Africa, rather an excessively optimistic title, I felt, but my editor wanted it. And that was all about how my take on the development of GM crops in Africa. So some of the advantages and some of the disadvantages of being in the field, and because you've got to have broad shoulders to be an activist in this field.
Yeah, I agree. I know I saw the first two books. I read them ages ago, probably more than a decade ago now, and really did find them to be very visceral. That in terms of you feel the deficit that we can correct with technology, and that we're blocking the technology from being there. And that's really what's great about, you know, when you're writing these books and preparing this kind of work, is do you think that in that we'll look back on this and really feel negative towards what happened? I mean, do you think that people, that this will ever take on a kind of a feeling of a beacon of, here's the mistake we made by holding back technology from people?
That would be great, but I'm not so sure that it's ever going to happen, because, you know, food is such an emotive issue. And when medicines are produced by genetic modification, it's sort of all or nothing. So people have to have them. And so, for instance, one of the latest ones came out, watched it on BBC News, that there's a young girl in the UK who suffers from a bacterial infection that is very rare and is very debilitating, and antibiotics don't help. So what they've been using are genetically engineered bacterial viruses, which are called bacteriophages, to kill these bacteria. And she says she was on the television just saying how different her life is. But I can't see the anti-GMO lobby saying you can't have that, because it's life-saving. But food is a different sort of, it's you know, you are what you eat. And so people feel that I'd rather have something quote-unquote natural.
Yeah, I thought a lot about this, and I think that it goes to the fact that when we talk about medicine, we're appealing to our cognitive synthesis. We're talking about a process that we are able to internalize and really think about, you know, and rationalize by using evidence, because it's medicine. But when we talk about food, especially fear around food, that appeals more to the reptile brain. And that's part of the brain which makes those fast decisions around fear and develops without cognitive processing. And
that's,
so I think,
interesting, yeah.
It really boils down to this kind of system one, system two thinking that some authors like Dan Kahneman have talked about. And the idea is that you can scare people you can easily scare people about their food. It's harder to scare them about their medicine. And I've got a million cases of measles in this country to say otherwise.
Precisely, yeah. So there are specific, I suppose, vaccines is a specific type of medicine, because you can't see the immediate effect. You can see the immediate effect on this young girl with a bacterial infection, but you can't, and you can see it in diabetes with insulin made in a yeast. But with vaccines, you can only see the effect when other people get it and you don't.
No, you hit the nail on the head. It's just something that if it's something you're not being affected by in a life and death situation, I would bet any of the anti-GMO activists, Greenpeace, that they would readily accept any of these CAR T therapies or any of these other advanced cancer therapies that are using genetic engineering. And I think that it really boils down to, how does it affect me? How does that's the big part of the problem in Africa, is that we're not there. I think, I mean, I felt very honored to have spent some time there and understand the problems a little bit better. So it's very different depending upon who you are and your perspective. And how do we, maybe that's our next job as communicators, is connecting people to what's actually happening with better media. And maybe that's our next mission. But
okay.
Well, Professor Jennifer Thompson, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I really appreciate it, and I'm really glad we got together. And please keep me posted if something else comes up that we can talk about sometime.
Thank you, Kevin. I certainly will.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Write a review on iTunes and share this with a friend. Most of all, help people understand that there are problems in the world that are really tremendous, where technology can be a part of the solution. And that when we integrate biotechnology with other types of technologies, we can have potential solutions that are customized for those in need. I'm Kevin Folta. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech.com. talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.